from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. When Louise Brown was born on July 25th, 1978 in England, she was the world's first test tube baby. And oh baby, a lot has changed in the past 25 years. In the U.S. alone, some 40,000 babies are now born with the help of fertility treatments every year. These little bundles of in vitro joy have given birth to a billion-dollar branch of medicine. Last Wednesday, President Bush's Council on Bioethics said that the fertility business needs to be more aggressively regulated. Critics warn it's another move by the religious right in the battle over reproductive rights. Supporters say the growing intersection of assisted reproduction and human genetics demands oversight. Tonight on Point, test tube babies 25 years on, and a Bush panel's push for greater government oversight of in vitro fertilization. Were you a test tube baby, an in vitro miracle? Have you given birth to one? Does this field need government oversight? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Tacoma Park, Maryland, is Rick Weiss, science and medical reporter for The Washington Post. Good evening and welcome, Rick Weiss.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us. Hope you'll walk us into this. We'll have listeners who know all about this and others who know very little. First of all, the field that we're talking about here, how do you define the dimensions of it these days?
Well, it's a field that, from one perspective, is simply trying to cure a medical problem or a disease, that of infertility, and it reflects the increasing ability of doctors to be able to help couples have babies who couldn't have them naturally. And that started with Louise Brown, of course, and techniques have gotten ever more complicated and better. From another point of view, it's a field of human experimentation or experimental medicine that is less overseen than a lot of other areas of experimentalism. And it's an interesting field that's somewhere in between there, and that along with the fact that, of course, it deals with reproduction, and so it has echoes of abortion and sort of the central controversy in our culture, has made it a hot spot for a long time, culturally, legislatively, ethically.
We read that more than a million babies at this point have been born through this widening array of in vitro techniques. At this point today, it goes on a lot. Lots of people use it. Give us, what's the basic technique here, Rick, and what are some of the frontiers where it's pushing?
Mm-hmm. Well, the basic technique, of course, is just to do outside the body what used to only happen inside the woman's body. That is to have sperm meet egg in a laboratory dish, mm-hmm. Create an embryo, usually letting it grow up to a few days old, and then transferring it into the womb of a woman to develop from there on. Now, things have gotten a lot more sophisticated from there, and one of the areas in particular that the President's Council on Bioethics was concerned about and that helped trigger its interest in doing this report mm-hmm. was an increasing frequency of genetic testing on embryos, which has been used at first to eliminate those embryos that carry genetic diseases and only place the ones that seem to be healthy into the woman's body, but which a practice which has expanded actually beyond that in interesting ways in the last few years. Just to be to explain to people how it works, you basically take a very early embryo in the dish, maybe 8 cells in all, and you can actually pluck one of those cells off of the embryo, leave mm-hmm. 7 behind, mm-hmm. do all kinds of tests on that single cell to find out whether it carries a disease or not, and then if it looks good, put that embryo in with its 7 remaining cells, and it develops apparently normally.
Right.
Now, you can go beyond just eliminating diseased embryos these days, and, for example, parents have been selecting embryos that have just the right tissue type so that child, when born, can serve as a blood donor or tissue donor for another sibling already born who has a disease and desperately needs a well-matched marrow transplant,
okay.
for example. You could go even further, and people have begun to go further, and eliminate those embryos that carry a gene that doesn't really guarantee that the kid's going to have a disease, but it leaves the kid with slightly increased odds of getting a disease late in life, perhaps an adult leukemia. And the question that arises, of course, is, you know, how far are we going to go in sort of selecting out or selecting in kids with various traits, and should there be any limits? Can we do this for not just medical things, but maybe aesthetic preferences?
So would-be parents and doctors could be selecting for height or for I don't know, complexion or hair color?
As we start to understand more about the genes that encode those traits, of course, most traits that we're interested in, like intelligence, have a lot of genetic components and other components, so it's not going to be that easy. Mm-hmm. But there is this sort of slippery slope argument that if we don't start getting a handle of this now, suddenly it's going to be out of control.
Now, Rick, bring us back around then to the President's Council on Bioethics. This whole field has been largely outside of federal government oversight and control, in part because the abortion issue made it a hot potato for the government for many years.
That's right.
How did this come onto the screen of this? What is this panel, and how did this come onto its screen, I guess?
Well, this is a panel of right now 18 folks of various backgrounds. They're philosophers, scholars of various sorts, medical and scientific people. And theologians who have been appointed by President Bush to provide advice to him on matters of biology and ethics.
This is the same group that looked at the stem cell research issue.
That's right. They've looked at cloning and stem cells, at enhancement, and a few other issues so far. And this area came to their attention actually a while ago when they were working on the cloning report, the human cloning report, and they realized in the course of doing research for that, well, no one seems to be really doing human cloning yet, but people are doing a lot of other things that we didn't really know about, and that we're a little bit nervous about, and so they decided to focus on this area and see, you know, in part whether regulations are adequate at this point, and if not, what sort of regulations maybe ought to be added.
Now, we'll come to what they actually said in the report, what they're recommending here, and it's just advisory at this point. But before we get there, there was tension coming up to this report being published relating to the abortion issue, right-to-life perspectives and free-choice perspectives. What's the political or ideological backdrop here?
Well, there's always concern, of course, that a bioethics commission appointed by a president of one party or the other is going to be biased. And in this case, of course, the concern was that you have a conservative president perhaps appointing a conservative bioethics commission that's looking to impose its conservative or impose conservative political values on an area of medicine or science. Here, there was a lot of concern at the beginning, both from the fertility specialty organizations, the groups representing fertility doctors and clinics, also very much so from the fertility patient advocacy groups, that this was going to be an opportunity for a conservative ethics council to come in and really gain control over reproduction, and in particular over female freedoms in reproductive freedoms, and sort of use it as another part of what many people have seen as the sort of closing noose around reproductive rights in this country.
Now, let me ask you just on that front, has in vitro fertilization been actively in the sights of the right to life crowd, the anti-abortion crowd, or has it been off away from their attention?
Well, it's been in a very weird middle ground, because on the one hand, people on the right have certainly expressed concerns about a field that seems to be playing God in a sense and tinkering with things that maybe shouldn't ought to be tinkered with. And at the same time, the government really ought to just stay completely at arm's length from this sort of practice, this branch of medicine and of medical research, because you don't want, if you disagree with these sorts of activities, you don't want federal tax dollars going into it. And indeed, one of the reasons why today there is not much in the way of federal oversight or regulation is because for decades now in this country, there have been various prohibitions on federal dollars going into this field at all. And virtually all the research that's done in human reproduction right now in this country is done with private money, basically with the profit margins from fertility clinics.
Mm-hmm. Rick Weiss, you report that in the event, what came out didn't have the most loaded language in it. It didn't refer to embryos as nascent human life or persons to be. But what did this panel last week advise the president, and through the president, I guess, ultimately the Congress?
Right. Well, there's sort of three levels of recommendations. First of all, the council realized that as much as they might have wanted to weigh in with some kind of rules or more specific recommendations, they found out that the most, perhaps the most sweeping, all things are going in the fertility field right now, again, in part because of the federal arm's lengthness here. So the first thing they call for is a lot of new studies to be done with federal funding, interestingly enough, and we'll see if that happens. Start doing better follow-up of mothers and of children created through assisted reproductive techniques to see how they're faring, to see if there are medical problems associated with some of these techniques, to see whether there are problems that haven't been tracked.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, they ask the fertility doctors and organizations to beef up their own self-regulation, which is mostly what's going on right now, or certain in-house rules. And then third, they do make some recommendations to Congress to pass laws, although they are, for the most part, recommendations to outlaw practices that most, you know, they say that most people in this country would be against anyway. And indeed, even though this council was somewhat diverse on these issues, the recommendations that they come out with for the for Congress are recommendations that everyone on the council agreed are a good idea.
And where does this push next? What's the propulsion that's embedded in these this guidance or advice?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, there's a long history in this country of ethics reports coming up from various groups like this one, and their main purpose in life seems to be to sit on a shelf and gather dust. One possibility. But this is a rather activist council, and certainly its chairman has been quite activist, especially in these areas.
This is Leon Cass at the University of Chicago.
Right. And, you know, we'll have to see. But frankly, it wouldn't surprise me if staff on the council were not already perhaps crafting some suggested language for Congress to consider that would carry out its recommendations. There may be people on the Hill doing that as well right now. And I suspect there are people in the reproductive medicine arena who are themselves crafting language right now, counting their toes somewhere, in the hopes of either having an influence on it or perhaps stymieing the process with a counterproposal. But it's hard to say. You know, it's a busy congressional year. It's an election year. I'm not sure this is going to rise to the top of the heap right away.
We'll see. Rick Weiss, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Gilbert Mailender. He joins us from Valparaiso, Indiana. He's a member of President Bush's Council on Bioethics, a professor of Christian Ethics at Valparaiso University, and a fellow at the Hastings Center. He's author of Body, Soul, and Bioethics. Good evening and welcome, Gilbert Mailender.
How are you?
Very well. Thanks a lot for joining us. Gilbert Mailender, did you vote on this on the council, and how did you stand on the report that came out? Are you happy with what the group has produced?
Well, as to the first question, I don't think we ever actually took a vote. There's almost nothing we've taken a vote on, in fact, during the course of the time, though there are plenty of opportunities for people to weigh in with their views and to express to raise questions,
sure,
or express dissent if they wish, and things get altered from previous draft and so forth. So in that sense, you're in a certain sense voting all the way along, but there wasn't some formal vote taken.
Do you like what's come out here? Do you like what's emerged here, and what do you hope it produces?
Well, I like many things about it. I think one of the best things about it is simply that it's been done. And what I mean by that is simply that biotechnologies that deal with the beginnings of human life have sort of grown up around us without a lot of thought about directions and limits and so forth. And the report, though I think actually its recommendations are very modest, and I think almost everybody on the council anyway understands it as quite modest in what it proposes, it at least begins to give a context in which to think about these questions, makes clear our need for further information on a variety of matters, and in that sense seems to me to at least set up a useful context for us to proceed from there. Now, you asked me another question. What did you say? Well, what do I think will come out of it, or what do I hope will come out of it?
Yes, what do you hope?
Well, I hope that the recommendation will be taken seriously by both executive and legislative branches in Washington, and that they will try to act on all or at least part of what we've recommended.
Gilbert Mailender, if you can stand by just a moment. Rick Weiss, we've got to take a short break. We'll come back and look at the key issues and how these guidance from the advisory board may affect them. We're talking tonight about test tube babies. 25 years on, are you a test tube baby? An in vitro miracle? Have you given birth to one? Does this field need government oversight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 800-800-8255. I'm Tom Anderson. We'll be back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about test tube babies, 25 years on, and a Bush panel's push for greater government oversight of in vitro fertilization. You can join the conversation tonight. Should the government be tracking this science and its offspring to see how it's going, where it's going, or is this the latest impingement on doctor-patient privacy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Rick Weiss, science and medical reporter for The Washington Post, who's been following this story. We're joined from Valparaiso, Indiana, by Gilbert Mylander. He's professor of Christian ethics at Valparaiso University and a member of President Bush's Council on Bioethics. We're joined right now from New York by Dr. Jamie Griffo. He's director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology at New York University's Medical Center. He's professor of obstetrics and gynecology at NYU. His clinic performs 1,200 in vitro fertilizations per year. In his career, he's been involved in more than 15,000 in vitro fertilizations. He's one of the first in the U.S., maybe the first, to successfully do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Jamie Griffo.
Thank you.
You're watching this, I am sure, with enormous interest. What do you make of this push out of Washington for government insight of in vitro fertilization and the science around it?
Well, I applaud the government's effort to try and understand some of the issues regarding our field. Although I'd like to make a point that our field by itself has set ethical guidelines. And in fact, I was a member of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine Ethics Committee in 1992, and many, if not all, of the issues discussed in this report have been addressed by our own internal bodies. And it was actually kind of interesting to see that there were really not very new or significantly new recommendations from this report. So what
are you suggesting with that, Dr. Griffo, that they should bug out? Or people are looking at this and saying this is serious, maybe they should pay attention.
No, I think what we do is very serious. And I think as a specialty, we take this very seriously. But it's actually quite surprising as a physician to hear other people who don't practice what we do discuss what we do. And it's actually very upsetting at times. I have read in the last 2 weeks a number of articles in very reputable newspapers talking about the unregulated field of assisted reproduction, which is actually the biggest lie that I've ever seen published. We are the most highly regulated group of physicians in the world.
You're saying our simply specialty, not regulated by government oversight?
That is absolutely not true. We have many levels of government regulation, both on the federal and state level. And on top of that, we've been ahead of the regulation because we've actually done things way before the regulations were put in place. For instance, Ron Wyden passed a law in 1992, the Fertility Clinic Specific Reporting Act. We were publishing data before Ron Wyden's law. And I don't have anything against regulation. What I do have a problem with is the understanding of what that regulation does. And there is no one looking at the impact of regulation. Regulation is all well-meaning, no question. Unfortunately, it has many unintended consequences. So let me give you an example.
Yes, such as?
Ron Wyden passed the law.
Ron Wyden, you're referring to?
He's a senator from Oregon, I believe, at the time.
Yep.
The Fertility Clinic Specific Reporting Act. There were a group of practitioners who were advertising success rates that were national and not within their particular clinic. And the fact is their clinic had no pregnancies at the time, and patients were coming to them thinking they were getting something that they weren't. This law was passed in response to that bad activity, which, by the way, happens by a very few people in our field and people who aren't members of our Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology. But the bottom line is this law got passed, and the way it was written was not actually a very good way. And SART, we actually helped correct it and worked with the CDC so that we could publish these reports yearly. And unfortunately, the unintended consequence of having a fertility clinic specific report was that patients looked at success rates, and that forced physicians to have the highest success rate. And one way to get the highest success rate is to put back more embryos.
So success rate, you're saying, how many babies emerging from how many operations? And so you're getting more twins and triplets and quads?
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
So I would suggest that we rename this the Fertility Clinic High Order Multiple Gestation Act, because we in America have the highest rate of, had the highest rate of multiples as a direct consequence, unintended consequence, of some very well-meaning legislation. Now,
so
the good
people
news
are getting
is,
used to seeing the double and triple strollers on the street, and very often those are the outcome of in vitro fertilization. You're saying it doesn't have to be with such a...
Well, it's a side effect. We are getting better. We've done a lot of research over the last 5 years to improve techniques, and we're on the cutting edge of that. And I'm happy to say that we have reduced the incidence of high-order multiples in our clinic very substantially by taking a very direct approach and methodical and scientific approach. And fortunately, that area of our research has not been regulated, because had it been, it would have taken us much longer.
Rick Weiss, I want to get you just for another minute. I know that's all we've got you. You can hear the kind of tension. Everyone's well-meaning here, and yet the doctor who's in the field doing this, you can hear Jimmy Griffo's worry that this is somehow going to interfere with what parents want when they, or would-be parents want when they come to him with the work that he does.
Well, you know, he's got a lot of good points, and I think it's obviously not a simple question, or we would have figured it out from now. I would argue that the problem of multiple births is a much more complicated one than that, and to blame it, you know, mostly on a piece of legislation that makes fertility clinics tell their rates is a little bit off base. But it has to do with other things out of the profession's control as well, including insurance issues, because, you know, the fact that this sort of procedure is mostly not covered by insurance does create a lot of incentive on patients and doctors to try to get a birth the very first time, because you can only afford to do it once. So these are complicated issues. You know, Europe has done, and other parts of the world have done much better than we have, though, at getting down to singleton and twins, and there's clearly is more that could be done. You know, it's a tough problem, because this is a branch of medicine. Medicine is regulated in various ways, mm-hmm. And at the same time, as this report points out, there is no other medical specialty that cures, quote-unquote, its patients by creating a baby. And that does arguably make this a different kind of medicine that is perhaps, you know, rightly subject to different kinds of rules or oversight.
Rick Weiss, I want to thank you so much for being with us and laying all the basics out for us tonight. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Rick Weiss, science and medical reporter for The Washington Post. Jimmy Griffo, Gilbert Mylander, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us, and I want to begin to invite them in. Anne is calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Well, you know, I'm bringing a perspective that comes from several different places to this issue.
Okay.
I'm a mother of two.
Yeah.
I have one biological child and one adopted child.
Okay.
And with my second child, prior to adopting him, I went through IVF and some less invasive fertility treatments. And I also did a brief stint on the board of directors of Resolve of the Bay State, which is a charity that helps parents trying to figure out what to do about their reproductive issues.
So did it work for you, Anne? Did you have an in vitro fertilization or not, ultimately?
I did. I had several. But my husband and I, we're fairly laid back, and we kind of said to ourselves, you know, this isn't really us. There are a lot of children in the world who need homes. We decided to adopt, but I will tell you what, I have never had a more positive medical experience in my life. While IVF didn't work for us, and ultimately we didn't choose to pursue it down a longer road,
yeah,
which many people do, it really struck us as an enhancement of a very natural process. And this is what I hope people will recognize, and why I hope that government intervention will be something we don't really have to face.
Do you welcome it at any level? Can you see some facets in which government oversight might actually be a positive thing here or not? You say it's working fine. Keep your distance, guys.
Keep your distance, guys, because I have never met a more professional group of people. They were so clear about the regulations that were governing them. They were so careful about regulating our experience and making sure that we were educated about this. This is not a particularly invasive set of procedures. Plastic surgery is significantly more dangerous and significantly more invasive. And, you know, we have to kind of have a benchmark for this.
And yet plastic surgery doesn't create babies.
It doesn't create babies, but this is creating babies. This is not creating unusual babies. This is not creating babies with enhanced characteristics. I don't think that there's a branch of the populace that's fueling, you know, genetic selection for blue eyes or blonde hair or this or that. These are people that are fueled by love and so much want to have these children and give them good homes. This is a branch of medicine that brings joy.
And we've got it. Thanks so much for your call, Dr. Jamie Griffith.
Yes, I wanted to make a point about the genetic engineering aspect of our field. I think that's a gross misrepresentation of what goes on. There are people who have genetic risk that they have a 25 to 50% risk of transmitting a genetic disease to their offspring. They either have a child that's died of a horrible disease or they have a child that's dying of a horrible disease. And our technology has allowed us to select embryos that don't have these diseases so these people can have healthy children. To represent that as the slippery slope that we're going to create the Arnold Schwarzenegger in a test tube, which is not even possible, and I don't ever see it being possible, is a gross misrepresentation of what we do for patients. No one spends time with these patients and lives their life that they live. They want to have a healthy child. Mm. Their life is devastated by this process, and we're able to really make a meaningful impact on the quality of their life. And the way it's represented is really upsetting.
Gilbert Mylander, you're on the Ethics Council. First of all, on this issue of human genetics, genetic engineering, and their intersection with in vitro fertilization, is that a particular area of concern? When you hear a caller like Anne say, this is beautiful and it's wonderful and please don't get in the way, which angles are you looking at that cry out for government oversight?
Well, one of the things, it's only one of the things, but one of the things that we were concerned about is precisely that certain kinds of practices, such as pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, simply aren't regulated and have grown up without the kind of thought that that is needed. That's all we said about it. But if people get so concerned about it, as Dr. Griffo is, it seems to me that we do need to think more carefully about it. After all, when we're selecting in or selecting out, we are making eugenic decisions. Now, these are privately made eugenic decisions. It's not a government eugenics program, such as we were familiar with from an earlier period in the 20th century, but it doesn't alter the fact that we are making eugenic decisions, and when that happens, it seems to me it's perfectly appropriate for someone to say, we need to take a look at this, we need to consider whether this is growing up without any attention on the part of any general attention on the part of our society. We need to find out more about precisely what is going on, and with that information, then we need to think about it.
And keep an eye on some technology that's moved very fast. David is calling from Revere, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you tonight?
Great, thanks.
I guess I also want to talk about the slippery slope, and maybe it's talking about in vitro fetalization, in vitro
fertilization, yeah.
Fertilization, yeah, is the wrong place to have that conversation. But I think it's a very big issue that's not being addressed right now, and I think that the Christian right may be on the correct side of this for the wrong reasons. I would draw a connection back to your previous hour where you were talking about policies creating a economic elite in this country. And I before the technologies go too far, I think it publicly needs to be addressed. How we're going to prevent these technologies from creating a genetic elite. About a year ago, you had this guy Kurzweil on your show who was talking about our cyborg future.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that these things need to be addressed soon. We need to before these technologies go much further. We need to define what a human being really is. And enhancements that we're not going to allow.
David, we've got it, and who doesn't understand that impulse? But Jamie Griffith, I hear you muttering your protest there. Yet you know that consistent public concern that these decisions collectively could add up to something that's very unfamiliar and maybe not even right. But you're saying, don't worry, this doesn't happen, and it won't happen.
Well, I think it's a misunderstanding. I think it's a misunderstanding about the power of the technology. We don't know the genes for hair color, eye color. Mm-hmm. We don't know how to select for them. We have no interest in selecting for them. We are taking a group of patients who have babies with horrible illnesses, cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs, Canavans. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of diseases mm-hmm. that people suffer terribly with, and their parents want to have healthy children. And they have a right to do that. We're not practicing eugenics any more than them having a CVS or an amniocentesis and then terminating a pregnancy that's affected with these horrible diseases. That it's just a gross misrepresentation of what we are doing. And if you're worried about it's a long-term effect on society as a whole, it's such a small percentage of the number of births in the United States. And to deny these people who have these horrible situations this care because of a fear of a misuse of technology, I think is very short-sighted.
Give us a sense of where the frontier is in the work that you do, where it butts up against human genetics. I was reading something this afternoon, I think, about cases in which the genetic material from three adults is used in the creation of one embryo. Have I got that right?
Well, yeah, but that's also a sensationalized approach to what actually was done. Well,
give it to us exactly how it is.
Yeah, sure. One of the big problems in IVF is as women get older, their eggs get older, and their eggs are less likely to make an embryo that makes a baby.
Okay.
Now, what we do for those patients is we say, look, your eggs are sick. We need to get a young woman's egg and do donor eggs. So we take a young woman's egg, husband's sperm, put that embryo in that woman, and we give this 45-year-old woman the pregnancy rate of a 30-year-old woman because she's been unable to have a pregnancy with her own eggs. Well, most women who and couples who face that would prefer to have their own genetic material. And we, since 1995, pioneered a technique called nuclear transfer where we could actually correct the defect in a woman's egg using a donor egg and putting her nuclear chromosomes into that egg and then creating embryos. Now, we didn't do this in a vacuum. We did years and years of costly animal experiments to learn that it could be done, to show that the offspring of these animals were healthy. We actually had mice bred through four generations after doing this technique to demonstrate that it was safe. And then we got institutional review board approval and informed consent from patients who wanted to try this. And we were stopped immediately by the FDA over concerns about safety. They wanted us to prove that it was safe. You can't prove it's safe. The only way you can prove it's safe is to try it. And there's pioneering patients who are willing to try it to find out if it's safe. And the thing about the nuclear material, the cytoplasm of the donor egg, the outer coating of the egg, has mitochondrial DNA from the donor, which is a very small percentage and codes for a bunch of genes that are pretty much the same among all of us. And yes, there are mutations in these genes, but the healthy donors don't have them. And there was the representation. In fact, Rick Weiss represented as the baby with three parents, which is a gross misrepresentation, a sensationalist and caustic misrepresentation of a promising line of research that has been stopped and now keeps our patients from benefiting from this potential technology. And that's a shame. And it's really misrepresentation and fear, and it's a shame.
It sounds like you'd be happier if the door were kept closed.
If the door were kept closed, in what way?
There wasn't too much public scrutiny that, you know, the guys inside and women doctors know what they're doing, and everybody else, please keep your distance.
Well, I really appreciate a public dialogue, and I think people should be involved and try and understand these things. But I think the real dialogue goes on in the office, the patient and doctor making decisions, informed decisions, answering difficult questions, exposing patients to known and unknown risks, and then them making a decision on their own, not by some regulator, telling them what risks they can or cannot take.
We've got to take a short break. Gilbert Mailander, Dr. Jamie Griffo, please stand by. We're talking tonight about test tube babies 25 years on and a Bush panel's push for greater government oversight of in vitro fertilization. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about test tube babies 25 years on and the Bush panel's push for greater government oversight of in vitro fertilization. My guest tonight from New York, Dr. Jamie Griffo, he has performed or been involved in more than 15,000 in vitro fertilizations. And from Valparaiso, Indiana, Gilbert Mailander, he's a member of President Bush's Council on Bioethics, professor of Christian ethics at Valparaiso University. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Barbara is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm always sort of stumped by this administration's fascination with embryos and the scrutiny that embryos get. And I just feel that this is, it's more of a strategy, again, with the abortion issue and personhood, and just like the bill that passed last week, and I'm baffled by it because, to me, embryos are products of conception. They aren't, they're potential life, but the way this administration and these people on these ethics boards talk about these embryos, it's as if they're living, breathing, kicking, laughing, smiling children. And I think it does us a great disservice. And I know this is a little off the topic, but I feel like it's all part and parcel of the strategy of this administration. And the thing that's sad to me is these people that I am a mother of a 16-year-old whom I adore more than anything. And I also had an abortion. And they're very different experiences for me. And I feel like, you know, this country is so twisted with its focus on managing and controlling what women do with their bodies and their lives. And in this case, couples, you know, couples who have these want these children. And now this is going to be attacked. And I think it's potentially a stem cell strategy, probably, which, you know, has great potential for healing living people, people who are alive.
Barbara, we've got a principal in this panel with us right here tonight. I want to just let you speak directly to Gilbert Mailander. Gilbert Mailander, you hear this line of concern from Barbara. From her perspective, this looks like an attempt to control reproduction. She may not want government involved in it. You hear the kind of fear that she's expressing here. From your perspective, is it well placed? Is she on to something?
And no, I don't think so. There are a couple things to say quickly, and then other things that would probably take longer. But I think that anybody who pays attention to the council, looks at its makeup, reads the transcripts of its meetings, could not suppose that we have been involved in developing some strategy of the administration. We've been pursuing our own course. It's a rather circuitous and argumentative course, but we're not taking orders from someone.
But you're named to the council by the administration.
Well,
there have been scientists who have fallen off in protest and said they weren't happy with what was going on there.
Well, there's no one who's fallen off. There was one scientist who was not reappointed for a second term.
Yeah.
A scientist who missed over half the meetings during the first term. So, I mean, I can talk about that.
But you know the kind of critique that she went out making, and we've heard it here as well. So are you just categorically saying that Barbara is wrong in hearing or smelling a kind of agenda here that's something more than the interest in science, that it's a – is there a values agenda here that's related to the right to life movement or the anti-abortion movement?
No. Let me make a couple comments. Of course there's a values agenda, though there's no single values agenda. This is a council on bioethics, all right?
Mm-hmm.
If we didn't talk about values, we wouldn't be what a council on bioethics is supposed to be about. But and we have taken up a number of issues that certainly do direct attention to the to human embryos and what one ought to think about them. And on those questions, we've been deeply divided. But for the most part, this report is not about embryos. This is about embryos who will become children, and what a society's responsibility, if any, ought to be toward them. That's what this particular report is about. And it remains the case that that procedure is one about which we know relatively little, which is not terribly regulated, and which can be used for eugenic purposes, not some bizarre eugenic purpose, which the council report itself makes clear isn't going to happen, not producing the next Arnold Schwarzenegger, but you can certainly get a boy or a girl.
But Barbara, I just want to let Barbara respond directly to Gilbert Mailander. Barbara, does this set you at ease? Is this what you want to hear?
You know, I don't care if people want to get a boy or a girl. I think it's absurd. Who cares? They're embryos. I'm sorry. I mean, that's my point. And I don't mean to sound heartless or thoughtless, but I really feel like we have to keep a perspective on the fact that these are products of conception that are at the earliest possible stages of life. And if somebody wants a girl over a boy, you know, I'm not going to judge them for that. I think it probably happens some way anyway.
But what if everybody wanted boys? It's happened in some countries, you know?
Not everybody wanted. It's true. I mean, it has happened in China because they end up having only one child. You know, there are other complicated things. I guess I wouldn't prefer that somebody wanted a boy or a girl, but I also think the technology is there. I doubt that they're doing that at any great level. It doesn't sound like this physician that's on the phone right mm-hmm. now would mm-hmm. do that.
Well, I don't, actually, and I've been not doing that since the beginning, in 1992, when we were able to first do it, because we didn't want to jeopardize this technology for our genetic
right.
patients.
And are you alone in that, Jamie Griffo, or are there others who are doing it?
There are people who are doing it, but it's such a small number, it will have no impact on population.
The issue is not the impact in terms of numbers. The issue is the way it teaches us to begin to think about the child as a product. That's the concern.
I totally agree with that. I don't value my female offspring more than my male offspring. I agree with you, but it's not my right to impose that on somebody else. But I don't want to get this on the topic of sex selection, because I think Barbara is on point on many aspects. You know, I've heard three times tonight that pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is not regulated. Well, I want to ask you, why is it that every patient that I have to send a form to New York State Department of Health asking their permission to do this procedure, mm-hmm. and there is a file with every single one of these patients in New York State, in Albany, of this procedure? Why is it that the first draft of this council recommended that we be required by law to keep track of every single embryo and what its disposition was and be able to report that to the government? What is that about?
What's your answer? What do you think? Jamie Griffo, if I may.
What do I think?
Well,
yes.
Wait a second. We'll hear, Gil,
if you would. But, Jamie, I'm just curious what you think about that.
Well, I'm not sure. But, you know, we live in a society where privacy – now, they've passed laws about privacy, so me as a physician, I can't even look through my own patients' charts and publish data without going through a very circuitous route, and yet John Ashcroft can go look through medical records about abortion so that he can then go and take doctors to task and put them in jail for doing something illegal. There's a little bit of hypocritical behavior in that.
All right. I want to say goodbye and thanks to Barbara. Gilbert Mylander, I hear you there.
Yeah, in the first place, we're being criticized now for something that appeared in a draft for discussion a long time ago, which we did not actually recommend.
Is this tracking of all embryos?
That's right. But if on the other hand, we want to talk about that issue, mm-hmm. certainly it's not difficult to understand that people might think it important to know what the disposition of a rather large number of embryos
yes,
produced
yes,
for
and
reproductive
every
purposes
patient in our clinic knows. Every patient in our clinic knows the disposition of each and every one of their eggs and embryos. That happens.
The society does not know.
But it's not your right to know what happens to my patient.
Well, you see, it's not sufficient to assert that. What one needs is arguments with respect to it. And insofar as we're talking about a procedure that produces children in whom the society has an interest, then it's always legitimate for us to think about what kinds of information and what kinds of regulations might be needed and appropriate.
I agree.
We may end up disagreeing, but it cannot simply be asserted. It has to be argued. And it seems to me that what the council did in this report is provide arguments in support of what I earlier termed and what I would repeat is a rather modest set of recommendations.
Let me take this. Sure, Jamie Griffo.
In 1988, there actually was a grant submitted to the National Institutes of Health, and I forget which sub-branch, and it was actually funded to follow IVF babies. It was actually done. Society for Assisted Reproductive Technologies, we pushed for that. And what came out of that study, it was very difficult to track these patients. Mm-hmm. Patients did not want their children under the microscope. Patients had a right not for them not to be under a microscope. And on top of that, when you track these kinds of babies, just the process of tracking them has an influence on the data that's collected. And no one has ever done that for the naturally conceived population. So we don't even have good control groups about what to look.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask about. And we just have a couple minutes left here. But the proposal to track long-term in vitro babies into childhood and, I guess, adulthood, what's the point? What are people concerned about there?
Well, they're concerned about the fact that we simply don't know for sure what the impact of assisted reproductive technologies might be on the health and development of the children who've been born with their aid. There have been a few reports in the last few years that suggest that we should not have been so confident that there were no negative impacts. And the point is simply to say, here's information that we do not know, we're simply ignorant about, and that we ought to know.
Jimmy Griffith, we just got half a minute left. Are you worried that the government is somehow going to end up shutting your work down, that people who want this kind of help won't be able to get it, or something else?
Oh, absolutely. I'm very worried. And, you know, I think it may be well-meaning on many people's parts, but I think there's a lot of agendas going on here, and I would like to know how much tax dollars was spent on this committee. How come citizens don't get have a right to vote whether a committee like this should exist? And how come there's not one patient or one embryologist or one reproductive endocrinologist on this committee? We're the people who know the field better than anybody, and we're not even represented.
Just remember that there are agendas on all sides, and remember that a large number of people brought testimony to the council and its deliberations.
Well, it's been a fascinating conversation. Gilbert Mylander, a member of the President Bush's Council on Bioethics, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Gilbert Mylander, professor of Christian ethics at Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana, and Dr. Jamie Griffo, director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology at New York University Medical Center. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, a reading from this year's winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. This is On Point. This year's Pulitzer Prize for Poetry was awarded yesterday to Franz Wright for his collection Walking to Martha's Vineyard. Wright is the son of the late James Wright, who won the Poetry Pulitzer in 1972 for his collected poems. When told he had won the prize this week, Franz Wright said, "I wish my father could share this moment with me." Franz Wright spent 2 years in a psychotic depression in the 1990s. He became a Catholic 3 years ago, a conversion he credits with saving his life. Many of the poems in Walking to Martha's Vineyard carry spiritual overtones. Here's a recording of Franz Wright reading Shaving in the Dark, one of the poems featured in his Pulitzer Prize-winning collection.
Shaving in the Dark. How old is the sun today? Where are the shoes of yesteryear? What an evil potato goes through, we can never know, but I'm beginning to resemble one. Ah, a little light now. It is the hour, the moment, when it becomes possible to distinguish a white thread from a black, so prayers begin. I see a shadowy reflection now, our fingers touch. There's nothing like what is. Fragile and momentary as the pale yellow light along the windowsill in winter, north of nowhere. Yet, if it were not for winter, nothing would get done, would finally get done. I've been all around this world, and not to die in hell, not to die in the flames of hell, homeless with a cell phone, please. There's nothing like today, and contributing one's atoms to the green universe. How strange is that? And some have managed to live in a constant awareness that all things, every evil thing, will be forgotten, dispensing to mourn for every radiant thing, and so seeing the radiance.
This year's new Pulitzer Prize winner for poetry, Franz Wright, reading his poem Shaving in the Dark from his winning collection, Walking to Martha's Vineyard. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.